Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And finally, we can report some real success, solid success at the Paralympics in Sochi. A gold, historic gold for U.S. snowboarder Evan Strong. We're also going to talk about the surprising success of the U.S. sled hockey Paralympians later this hour. We are finishing up a week of examining the possibility that we might all live a lot longer. And what does that mean for healthcare, for medicine, society, its priorities? Planning for how we will live after 70, if indeed that time stretches out for many decades in the future. One part of that discussion is to make the healthcare system work better. Young people are going to have to pay into a national system for covering medical bills. Later this hour, a discussion of what it actually takes to get young people to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. The deadline is looming. It's tough, though. One of you in Placerville, California, told us, as a healthy millennial, paying the penalty is less than coverage for the remainder of 2014. Or from New York, I can't afford it, too busy, don't go to the doctor, so I'd rather just pay the $95 fine. But they'll have to catch me first. We're going to end this hour and week looking bigger at the issue of longevity. Big philosophical questions are raised by an expectation of a very long lifespan in the future. A question for you is, what you think of as your best self associated with a particular age, or is it cumulative? Are you all the years lumped in together? At what age were you your best and truest self? Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE, tweet at The Takeaway, or start a conversation at thetakeaway.org. We begin, though, with an international crisis that seems to be colliding with domestic politics in the U.S. Crimeans go to the polls on Sunday to potentially decide to leave Ukraine, defy the Ukrainian constitution, and rejoin Russia. Meanwhile, lawmakers on Capitol Hill are experiencing a disagreement over what to do about the Ukraine crisis, a disagreement that has the potential of further diminishing the United States' already dubious clout in this confrontation with Russia. Joining us now, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So, Todd, I want to play you two impassioned statements on the Ukraine crisis from Capitol Hill. I know you're familiar with them. First, here's a statement of outrage and humanitarian principles from outspoken supporter of Ukraine, Republican Senator John McCain.
An incredible example of a failure to understand the nature of this situation and the threat Ukraine faces. And it's really a shameful period, in my view, of the United States Senate.
Now, here's a statement of outrage over a lack of principle in domestic U.S. politics from Democratic Senator Richard Durbin.
If you submitted that plot line that we can't protect Americans and our friends overseas unless we protect the Koch brothers to the House of Cards, they reject it as a script. Incredible. No one would take that position or believe it.
But that's what's going on. Todd, what is going on regarding the issue of Ukraine on Capitol Hill right now?
This is U.S. aid to Ukraine. You heard two senators there, John, maybe exaggerating a little bit as to the gravity of what's going on, but you can hear the frustration from both of them. Let me take you back to earlier this week to get this story started. Arseniy Yatsenyuk, he's the acting prime minister of Ukraine, was on Capitol Hill, spoke to a group of us reporters. Listen.
The package of the financial aid, which is to be assumed as $1 billion of guarantees, is a first real and concrete step how to stabilize the situation in my country.
How does that collide with the Koch brothers, as Durbin was saying?
And to the PM there, you say not so fast, because here comes the conversation about the Koch brothers. Here's what has happened with that $1 billion of loan guarantees that the PM says his country so desperately needs. And they do need it. The Ukrainians are into the Russians for $2 billion in unpaid oil revenues. They're on the hunt for cheap gas. The Ukrainian economy is not doing well. Those loan guarantees are important. John, the House has passed $1 billion in loan guarantees. The Senate is poised to pass a bill, but the Senate bill's different. Democrats said, if we're going to pass this $1 billion in loan guarantees for Ukraine, let's add on some IMF, International Monetary Fund reforms. Reforms that we've been wanting, that the IMF has been wanting since 2010. This goes all the way back to then. It kind of reshuffles the way countries contribute to the IMF, changes some of the formulas. Republicans say, that doesn't have anything to do with the Ukraine. Forget about the reforms you've been wanting for 5 years. Let's just do the money. Well, Democrats are insisting, we want our reforms. The White House wants the reforms. John Kerry wants the reforms. Well, John, here comes the Koch brothers' curveball. Republicans say, okay, as long as we're talking about the Treasury Department and the International Monetary Fund, you want your IMF reforms to piggyback on this Ukraine money? Then we want another part of the Treasury Department, the IRS, to hold back on their new rules clamping down on 501c4s, otherwise known as social welfare organizations, otherwise known as super PACs.
That's exactly right.
Now, Dick Durbin's being a little unfair. This doesn't have anything directly to do with the Koch brothers. He only says that because that's the Democrats' boogeyman when it comes to super PACs. But he is correct that the idea of the IRS cracking down on what these C4s can spend and when and what qualifies as a social welfare organization versus just a political mega money machine has gotten tied up in the aid that everybody says Ukraine so desperately needs.
You know, I don't know if it's much of an argument. I mean, at least the IMF reforms do have something to do with U.S. foreign policy. The C4 reforms, if you want to call them there, for the IRS, are only about domestic politics. I'm wondering if there's a wide sense, or if John McCain believes this, that all this dispute is undercutting John Kerry over in Moscow meeting with his counterpart, Foreign Minister Lavrov.
Not just John Kerry. McCain believes that because McCain himself, with a group of seven or eight other senators, has landed in Ukraine just this morning, John. They flew over last night after the Senate session, so they're there to try to show some solidarity for the Ukrainians. And yes, John McCain thinks it does undermine us. Now, I want to point out, other members of the Senate and the House who are in on the inside of this say, look, it's not really a huge, giant issue because Yatsenyuk knows that he's going to get his money eventually after this squabble is over. He can't spend all of it right away anyway, so it's okay. And the Senate has struck a deal that's going to get the Senate bill on the floor and passed in about 2 weeks. But John, here's why I'm here to tell you the fight's not over. The House does not like the Senate bill. House Republican leadership aides, Republican aides are telling me, we're still not going for this IMF reform. We're still concerned about it. We still want to hold back on these on this clampdown on the 501c4s. And if the Senate wants to get this bill done, they're going to have to deal with us on the spending, and they're going to have to deal with us on the Koch brothers, aka the super PAC issue. It's not over.
Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You bet.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. There has been no focus to speak of on the crisis in Venezuela on Capitol Hill recently, and the political turmoil is expected to continue to simmer until well after lawmakers get back from their week-long recess. Maybe there should be more U.S. focus on the political situation in Caracas. To bring us up to date on events in Venezuela is Girish Gupta, a journalist based in Caracas. Thanks for joining us.
Hey there.
So what would you say is, the theme this week in the political turmoil that really has persisted?
Well, I mean, here on the ground in Caracas and across the country, I'm seeing the protests just rumble on. They keep going. It's been 4 weeks now in Caracas, about 6 weeks across the country. And what's really got me is that every single day there's barricades on the street. Every day we're getting the tear gas and the petrol bombs from obviously the authorities and the protesters themselves. And it just keeps going. And that's what's really getting to journalists and analysts here. We weren't expecting this. Normally, we have seen protests like this before in Venezuela over the years, and normally they last a few days generally, and that's it. And that's demonstration to me that this is all very organic. I speak to people at the barricades, the people throwing rocks and petrol bombs, and they tell me they don't care about the politicians. They don't care about Enrique Capriles, the opposition leader, or Leopoldo López, another opposition leader who's now in jail for instigating the protests. And that, to me, is very interesting. It's not about the politicians on the ground.
And what you've described is really what makes this crisis distinctive and also maybe a little bit frustrating in comparison with what's going on in Ukraine, in that there is no real formal political process for the protesters to express their views. We're far away from an election. There's no sense that there will be new elections. And the protesters have really made a gamble that they can express their views completely outside the channels of power. How long do you think this can go on?
Well, that's exactly it. Now, electorally, there's no means for the protesters to achieve their aims. And their aims are very loose. They're very abstract. They want change. They're sick of 56.3% inflation over the last year, of 70 deaths every single day. It's one of the worst murder rates in the world. That's what they're sick of, and they want a change. They want an end to the presidency of Nicolas Maduro. But that, electorally at least, is not going to happen for at least a couple of years when they have the chance for a referendum. So I asked them, you know, what are you hoping to achieve? And they don't really know. This is a lot. There are a lot of kids out there, a lot of teenagers, a lot of students, of course, and older people, of course, across the country. But they're not entirely sure how to achieve that aim. Now, Nicolas Maduro is very unlikely to step down. And, of course, the only other option is a coup. And there seems no evidence that that's in place or anything's been organized to that end.
One of the other issues that's facing President Maduro is the legacy of Hugo Chavez, in the sense that Venezuela has conducted itself in a very isolated way in the region for quite some time. President Maduro has tried to change that, but I'm wondering if that sense of isolation makes it hard for Venezuela to reach out to neighbors, as we saw this meeting in Santiago, Chile, to get assistance, even financial assistance, from other countries in the region.
Well, I mean, the problems, especially the economic ones, are very much down to currency controls enacted just over a decade ago by Chavez himself. That's meant there's a real shortage of dollars, which leads to a shortage of products on the shelves. You can't get flour easily. I was in Tátira, which is on the border here with Colombia, a few days ago, and that's where this all began. Actually, that's where it's most organic. And I was at a supermarket and saw people lining up for 7-8 hours out in the sun for things like flour, for vegetable oil. And this is a major issue here. So yes, you've got the economic issue from that, which is the legacy of Hugo Chavez. And as you say, it's difficult yet necessarily to reach out to neighbouring countries. There has been some warming of relations with, say, Colombia next door over the years, but that very quickly falls apart. And obviously the US and Venezuela don't have the best relationship.
What about the fatalities that have occurred during this unrest? Is there any momentum gained there in the sense that, as we saw in Ukraine, the fatalities in Kiev were really the means by which public support was mobilized for a real ouster of the leadership? Is that happening? Is that momentum gaining in Venezuela on any level?
It is, actually, yes. And that's across the country. There were three deaths in Carabobo State the other day, a couple of days ago. And that really did galvanize people over in Tátira as well, in the west where I was. The deaths there have galvanized people. They do, but you've got to remember that the deaths are on both sides, and both sides are using the deaths for political reasons. They're overdoing the deaths as well. They're inflating the figures, both sides. There's been about 28 deaths so far. But remember, this is also in a country where there's 70 deaths every single day, according to NGOs here. And so, in a sense, in a sort of very cold-hearted way, the 28 deaths over the last month do pale into insignificance compared to those 70 every single day.
Looking at the calendar, Garish, what's the next landmark, next event that may test both sides here?
Well, I guess the next litmus test is the break, the Easter holiday, essentially, in about a month's time. And that will be a gauge of whether people are willing to stay on the streets or whether they're all going to go to the beach on holiday. And then, like I said, electorally, really in the next couple of years, that's when things are really going to be gauged at the polls. But that's a long way away, and that's way too far away for a lot of these protesters.
Garish Gupta is a journalist based in Caracas, Venezuela. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
1992. Candidate Bill Clinton goes on the Arsenio Hall late night show to do the Elvis thing with his saxophone. The young crowd goes wild. 2014, another milestone in the bully pulpit's quest to get the attention of young people.
Okay, let's get this out of the way. What did you come here to plug?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't be with you here today if I didn't have something to plug. Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work. Why would you get the guy that created the Zune to make your website?
President Obama with comedian Zach Galifianakis on the web-based show Between Two Ferns, trying to get young people to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. The difference here is that while Bill Clinton was trying to be cool, President Obama needs to get young people to act. Young people have already voted for Obama in far greater numbers than voted for Bill Clinton, but now it's time to get them to spend money to sign up for that Affordable Care Act with the enrollment deadline just over 2 weeks away. Mary Agnes Carey joins us, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Also with us is Josh Carpenter, the co-founder of Bama Covered, which employs volunteer college students to encourage ACA enrollment in the state of Alabama. Josh, welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
So, Josh, anything persuasive about the president going on a very youth-oriented program like Between Two Ferns to get this message out?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's a contrarian way to get in front of young people, but I think it has a large viewership. But I generally can't speak to who all has been viewing that program. I think that it's part of a series of efforts of organizations, both governmental and non-governmental, to get in front of young people in ways that engage them and at turfs that they're comfortable with.
Is the White House, in your view, doing that? Do you notice that in the people that you're talking to, or are you pretty much starting from zero with a lot of the people that you're encountering down there in Alabama?
I was born and raised in Alabama, and one thing that's true is, you know, people take their cues from folks who mean the most to them. So our approach is very much locally based. We don't really pay attention to what's going on nationally, simply because we believe that people respond to conversations with people that they trust. Healthcare and the decision to enroll or not enroll is intensely personal. And no matter what national media cues are saying, people listen to the influencers in their lives, whether that's their pastor, the coach in their community, or, you know, teachers or barbers. Those are the folks we try to talk to and just begin to create the space for an open and honest conversation.
Josh Carpenter in Birmingham, Alabama. That's a great point, Josh. What do you think of that takeaway, Mary Agnes Carey? If all politics is local, all healthcare decisions are personal.
Well, I think it's completely true. I mean, in most households, for example, the women make the decisions about healthcare. People have to decide what this means for them. That's always been a staple of this healthcare law. We, as you're talking about, we've got all sorts of ways to reach out and try to get people to enroll. But people are going to have to get online, look at the options. Can they afford them? Do they qualify for a subsidy? People have to understand what it means to have health insurance or not have health insurance. And that's been one problem for the administration. This law is pretty complicated. And for people to be able to sort through it, for the administration to try to communicate it through a video or a soundbite sometimes is tough to do. So I think that this is really kind of a ground game where people have to think about it from their own perspectives.
And I'm wondering if, you know, that's reflected in some of the comments we've gotten from Houston, Texas. I just haven't made the time. Also, the last time I looked, it looked unaffordable to me. Or here's a young person from Orlando. The fine is much less than the insurance, and the insurance will cost much more per year than I spend on my medical expenses. If that's the case for most 18 to 34-year-olds, we're not going to get much beyond the 27% of enrollment, Mary.
Well, that's true. And to back that point up, when you look at the fine for the first year, right, it's $95 or 1% of income, whichever is greater. People kind of forget about that 1%. So the fine might be greater than the person's really thinking about. But the thing to remember is if you don't have insurance, you don't have insurance, okay? So something happens to you, you get in some kind of accident, you blow your knee out in the basketball court, that kind of thing, you're still on the hook for that expense. So while you look at the premium, the monthly premium, and think, gosh, this is too expensive for me, what's it going to be like to pay for a hospital emergency room visit when you don't have health insurance? That's pretty expensive too.
Although, Josh, you know, how do you make that argument to young people who feel like they've thought it through? Here's someone from Salem, Oregon. I'm not going to participate in the ACA. I should have the freedom to determine how best to utilize and direct my finances. I'm on a tight budget, racked up credit lines. I'm in a younger demographic. I can afford my own health care, but will only purchase health care services directly from a doctor only when I need it. Do not feel obligated to pay for some 55-plus-year-old's inability to quit smoking or avoid cheeseburgers and sugar. I'll take care of myself. Thank you very much. How do you argue against that, Josh?
First of all, I think that individual makes some pretty interesting points. I mean, for us, it's about making, you know, the academic term would be making making things proximal and salient, making the story real and how it affects you. You know, a broken arm costs $2,500 to be diagnosed, $16,000 to be surgically adjusted. In having the conversation about stories nearby, you know, one of our student volunteers, for instance, in Huntsville, signed up for a plan for less than $20 a month. Some of our grad student captains in South Alabama signed up for plans for less than $15 a month. And then, you know, there's the other side of that coin where one of our student volunteers tells us a, sort of a gut-wrenching story about how she sat on the couch next to her 34-year-old uncle as he passed away from a congenital heart disease that went undetected because he didn't have insurance. I think it starts with the stories. And honestly, the entire bill is so complex that unless people are willing to engage in a conversation and engage with an open mind with someone that they feel that they can trust, it just doesn't happen.
So it's got to be more than just between two ferns, but the stories you're telling, Josh, seem pretty compelling. Good luck there.
Thank you.
In Birmingham, Alabama, Josh Carpenter is co-founder of Bama Covered, which is a volunteer organization that works to increase enrollment in the ACA. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Mary, thanks as always.
Thank you.
So is there a story compelling enough for you to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, or does money rule here?
Hi, my name is Natalie. I'm calling from Queens, New York. And regarding the healthcare question, I can't afford it. Rent is high, and I'm a single parent of two girls without child support. This affordable care is not really helping people like me, unfortunately.
Tell us your story at 877-8MYTAKE or facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at reputation.com.
We are the pioneers, and we are going to be the one who set the stage for the rest of the sport.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
You never let your guard down and always play hard as you can play.
This is the home stretch right here. One more feature to navigate.
You know, just got to go with what you got.
This isn't just about skiing.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
It must have been a call to action for the beleaguered, medal-starved Team USA at the Paralympics because the sled hockey skaters pulled it out in Sochi against the feared Canadians, 3-0, in yesterday's semifinals. So it's a gold medal face-off against Russia where the Paralympians will have the chance to redeem the humiliation of the able-bodied U.S. skaters who came up short at the recent Winter Olympics. And so our Paralympic profile today is Nico Landeros, a member of the 2014 U.S. sled hockey team, one tough skater with a neck as wide as an 18-wheeler, shoulders you might see lifting steel at a construction site, but this linebacker dude weighs only 185 pounds, which is an easy weight to maintain if you're missing both of your legs.
You know, I got in a bad accident when I was younger, and, you know, we played football, wrestled, played hockey most of my life, and, you know, just got to go with what you got.
What's the skill level for you versus someone who has a single leg, or are there even sledders out there with spinal cord injuries who have both legs out there on the ice?
I think it's an advantage for people with no legs. You've got a shorter bucket, which is really nice. You're protected. My bucket has it's fully protected. I think it's an advantage in lots of ways for turning really fast. My upper body strength really helped me with just speed. I'm a bigger guy, so I like to hit. You know, some of the guys are a little smaller that have no legs, and, you know, they still hit really, really hard. And I like to bang out there, and scoring goals is a great, great feeling as well.
How hard is it to be conscious of your propulsion and conscious of where the puck is? Because in many situations, you're turning and shooting at the same time, and an able-bodied hockey player has got arms to deal with the shot and legs to deal with the propulsion. You're doing both with the same limbs.
It's pretty difficult just because you're pushing with your arms and you got to control the puck at the same time, and sometimes you got to shoot or you got to pass. And that was the most difficult part for me to learn.
And can you do one of those like wild back shots that actually come off the backside of you and go into the net? That I've seen some of these guys do where they're in a twirl and all of a sudden the puck like erupts from the back of them?
Yeah. We do a lot of crazy stuff. I pick the puck up behind the net and I throw it behind my back just like, you know, Crosby did in a couple of games. And, you know, it's a pretty sweet move to do, but you got to do it at the right times.
Now, are there any rules in sled hockey that, you know, are kind of like soccer or, you know, wheelchair tennis where, you know, you get a two-bounce rule in tennis or any sort of compensatory rules about handling the puck because you're down so close to it?
Nope. Hockey's hockey, so, I mean, it's the exact same rules. We can't fight. It's international. So the only change in it is T-boning, which is when you get hit with the sled directly at a 90-degree angle, and that's the only change in the game.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the equivalent of picking up a chainsaw with somebody. I mean, that you can't even do that with able-bodied hockey. That sled is a dangerous weapon in the wrong hips, I guess, right?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, you just got to fight through it. We got a lot of big pick marks in our bodies, and, you know, it's just part of the sport.
So I noticed you volunteered when I asked you, are there any rules that are different? The first thing that you said, I think, was we're not allowed to fight. So you like to fight normally when you play hockey?
You know, it's a big part of the game, I think. You know, someone comes out on your goalie, runs them, you know, slashes them, and you got to make a point out there. You don't want anyone to touch your goalie. And in this league, we can't fight, but, you know, they let a lot of things go, and especially when it's in the crease, you know.
Well, Nico, I'm looking at your headshot. I mean, from your dentist's perspective, it would seem as though you've come out pretty well on the end of all of your fights so far.
Yeah. I've been really lucky. I've only gotten in a few fights. You know, when I had legs, I liked fighting, and it hasn't changed a bit. Now it's just you gotta control yourself a little bit more and not get a penalty and just focus on the game and winning.
All right, Nico, good luck to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, and thanks for having me on the show.
Nico Landeros is a member of the U.S. Paralympic sled hockey team. They face off against Russia for the gold medal on Saturday.
Once upon a time is how these stories usually begin. In a world where laughter was king. In an outpost on the edge of space. Protecting the Earth from the scum of the universe. In a story about our lives. At least that was the plan. But one wrong flight can ruin your whole day.
Movie Friday. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, a culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Movie themes this week, America's movie voice. You heard it there. Boy gamers with cash, girl fans with attitude. And I guess Wes Anderson brings us all together at the movies this week. Let's start with the Need for Speed. Yet another video game becomes a movie. Let's listen.
Oh, wait. See, they're trying to trap us. You're just stripped onto the shoulder.
No, I'm going for the Hummer. He's a pavement prowler.
Pavement what?
It's a show car with a big lift kit. Makes up for his inferiority complex.
You are crazy!
So, boy flick, Kristen, but I suspect irresistible for Hollywood with the success of Fast and Furious and the problems with that with the fatality of its star.
I have no idea of who this is irresistible for, actually. You know, Aaron Paul fans might be excited from Breaking Bad. Aaron Paul stars as a slightly down-on-his-luck auto mechanic who is going to try and get ahead by doing one very edgy race, and he has the help of a British secretary, that's Imogene Potts, alongside him there. Racing very quickly, frequently against traffic, often at over 200 miles per hour. And I just felt it was incredibly socially irresponsible. You see all these cars crashing around them and people dying, but it doesn't matter because it's all in good fun.
They're not real cars. They don't add to the carbon in the environment.
It just seemed awful watching the whole thing, seeing everyone else die while they give each other high fives.
All right. So, Rafer, if we're talking about if you love the game, you'll see the movie didn't work with Tomb Raider, didn't work with Doom. Does it work here?
It doesn't really work. I mean, I think if you're, I think even a fan of the video game is going to want a better story than this one has. The story, even for a car flick, is pretty dopey. And I have to agree with Kristen. I think there's something a little weird about the way that these guys behave. It's not just the plowing into oncoming traffic. That, you know, you can forgive that, but they clip bicyclists. They play dodging with a bus full of school children. There's a lot of stuff in here that just doesn't seem that great to me. And I think even if you're a video game fan, that might kind of raise your hackles a little bit.
Stay tuned for Grand Theft Auto, I guess. We have that to look forward to. Who knows? All right, so the backstory of this movie is really the deal. Listen.
In a lesser-known epic poem, Dante's Inferno 2, Hell Freezes Over, 10 years after escaping the Nine Circles, Dante returns. You know, for old time's sake. Have a couple shots, catch up with the gang.
Name?
Veronica Mars.
No way. You look so different. I barely recognize you.
The return of Detective Veronica Mars from the 2004 TV series brought back by the fans. Rafer, how does this work?
Well, Rob Thomas, the show's creator, was very disappointed when the show was canceled, third season back in 2007. He left the end of the show hanging. He didn't want to resolve it because he still had hopes that somehow he could resuscitate this narrative. The fans basically contributed money to a Kickstarter campaign. It broke Kickstarter records for fastest to reach 1 million, then 2 million. It reached 5.7 million, and now here it is on the big screen.
Cult classics, a lot of the comic book franchises really come from intense fan bases making something that's mainstream. Does this work?
I think if you're a fan of the show, it's going to be a very happy event. Basically, everybody's here. Kristen Bell obviously is here. Martin Starr, Kristen Ritter is in it. Basically, every single person that ever appeared on the Veronica Mars show is here, along with some new people. James Franco, of course, makes a cameo. What's a movie without James Franco?
There you go.
But I think if you're not a fan, there's not going to be a lot here to draw you in.
Who's not a fan of Wes Anderson, Kristen?
He's adorable. People love him. Everything's beautiful and cute. But he has been accused sometimes of having only cute and not a lot of substance.
Well, the wide release Grand Budapest Hotel. Let's listen.
Experience.
Hotel Kinski, Kitchen Boy, 6 months. Hotel Berlitz, Mop and Broom Boy, 3 months. Before that, I was a skillet scrubber.
Experience, zero. Education.
I studied reading and spelling. I started my primary school. I almost finished.
Education, zero. Family.
Zero.
Does this work, Kristen?
You know, normally, like I said, there's a little bit of a debate of whether or not Wes Anderson is all cute and no substance. This time around, I actually felt there was some real heart here. You have Mr. Gustav, played by Ralph Fiennes, who's the concierge of a very high-end hotel, who takes a young lobby boy, Zero, played by Tony Revolori, under his wing, and he helps this young boy through professional obstacles through life, and then things kind of get turned around and the lobby boy ends up helping him quite a bit. And I really thought this was a sweet one. It had some substance and everyone was just so fun to watch. And there are always those great cameos. You had Jude Law in it. You have Bill Murray, of course, Tilda Swinton, everyone who you just love in the Wes Anderson universe.
Finally, let's remember that in a world where all movie trailers used music like this, virtually all trailer announcers were in this voice.
What happens when your partner in crime is having the time of their life while you're playing dead? Revenge.
Movie trailer announcer Hal Douglas there, familiar voice you heard at the beginning of this segment as well, really marked the change in movie marketing. He died at age 89. Rafer, movie marketing, movie trailers really changed at the time that Hal Douglas began a career of voicing trailers.
Sure. I mean, back then, I think you really needed that authoritative, resonant, baritone voice, that kind of voice of God. You wanted that in a trailer. Even if it was a comedy, you wanted to hear that because that voice could punch things up, make you laugh, poke a little fun at things. You really almost never hear voiceovers in trailers anymore. You hear them in car commercials. When I think of voice actors, I think of cartoons and things like that. But they're a lot of times it seems like they're gone from the trailers these
Douglas
days.
Douglas Save, do you have one?
Could be Lethal Weapon, but I do like the parody he did of himself in Comedian, the Jerry Seinfeld trailer.
In a world where laughter was king.
No in a world, Jack.
What do you mean, no in a world?
It's not that kind of movie.
Okay. In a land that...
No in a land either.
In a time...
Nah, I don't think so.
In a land before time.
Waterworld was one of those kind of movies, right, Kristen?
Oh, absolutely. Is there a better Hal Douglas trailer? It has all the things you want, the authority, the terms like beneath a watery grave.
And fronting a bad movie.
And, yeah, it just makes one of the worst movies of that year sound like one of the greatest movies of all time.
The future. The polar ice caps have melted. And the Earth lies beneath a watery grave. Those who survived have adapted to a new world.
Kind of like actor Kevin Costner, who survived Waterworld. The rest of us, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Weinzer, thanks so much. What's in the podcast this week?
We have a Veronica Mars fan who helped fund the new movie.
Rafer, and film critic for Newsday, Kristen Weinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They are the podcast. Go see it at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
In ancient times, being a senior was apparently no big deal. The Bible's Methuselah, 10 centuries and change. Busy Abraham waited until he was 100 and his wife Sarah 91 before they settled down to have their first child, Isaac. Peng Zhu, 4,000 years ago, according to Chinese legend, saw his 800th birthday. Tiresias in ancient Greece had a sight impairment, which may explain his early death at just over a reported 600 years. No exercise program, interested meditation, or suggested diet from these aged men and women has survived for us to try and emulate, so there you have it, a mystery. We 21st century humans are just going to have to be humble about all of this. From Cadillac, Michigan, one of you says, I don't know, but I imagine I would grow tired of life after 100 years. If everyone could become centenarians, I would fear the cost to society and lack of jobs. Or Dave, who tells us, it's all relative. A few years ago, I acquired a form of leukemia that was lethal 20 years ago. With new targeted drug therapies, my life expectancy is now typical. My typical mortality is sweeter than any promise of immortality. Shelley Kagan, the Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, says that a vastly greater life expectancy around the world poses fundamental identity questions for each of us, questions about who exactly we are.
Well, if people suddenly lived to, instead of living to 80, on average lived to 150, that would double the population, which means then we don't have room for everybody. And so that implies that we would then have to cut back on the number of children that people have. Right away, that pushes families in different directions from the ones we're used to. Leaves the question, what happens to the parents? Instead of having the 20 years plus that we're raising the children in the house now, we would have decades, really 50 or more years, in which we were still in prime health, at least that's what we're imagining, but our children would have left the home. And so now the central project of our lives for most of us currently, raising our children, has to recede. And so we then have to ask, what's replacing that? Does the role of being a grandparent become a more significant one? Does the role of becoming a great-grandparent or a great-great-grandparent, a role that doesn't even exist now for all practical purposes, does that become a significant one? What would that look like?
It seems like we evolve back to a sense more of extended families rather than siloed individuals. I mean, the idea of parenting under this scenario of living 150 years becomes an episode kind of like high school. I mean, sure.
That's right. Exactly. And so one possibility, the one you just sketched, is that extended families across many generations might come to the fore. But of course, a completely different possibility is that family recedes from importance and that we won't have deep connections with our great-grandchildren or our great-great-grandchildren or our great-great-great-grandchildren. And so family life would have to become a less important part of our life than it currently is. You can't simply add 50 years or 80 years to our lifespan and think you're just going to plop that into life as we know it and everything else stays the same. Suppose that technology got to the point where we could replace organs at will with synthetic livers, synthetic lungs, so forth and so on as things wear out. And so now we can live, in principle, it looks as though we can live in centuries or longer. But then we have to ask what's happening to the human brain. The human brain, like any other organ, would eventually wear out, presumably. So imagine that the scenario that now is that when that stage is approaching, we upload the human personality of the given individual onto some computer chip or synthetic brain so that all of your memories and desires and beliefs and goals and ambitions are uploaded onto this chip, which is then that chip then gets placed in to the new synthetic brain. All right, that offers a scenario in which conceivably we might continue to live, but now we have to face the philosophical question, is that still you?
Yeah. Who is you? Are you a physical domain, or are you simply an embodiment? And again, you know, who you are at age 20 is different from who you are at age 80, which then would be different from who you are at age 150.
Right. There's a very deep philosophical question. It's known as the nature of personal identity or the persistence of identity across time. That the thought that almost all of us work with is that although I've changed in many, many ways from the person I was when I was 20, I have many new experiences, many new goals, lots of different memories from the person that I was when I was 20, and I'll be different yet again if I make it to 80. But for all that, there's a single person that has persisted through these changes. I've survived those changes. But there's a quite complicated philosophical issue of what kinds of changes are changes I can survive and what kinds of changes are changes that I can't survive. If we have the person with the brain copy or the duplicate, is that me? Am I surviving the change of brain? Or is that rather simply a kind of Xerox of me? Really, we have to turn strictly to philosophical speculation, metaphysics, to face the question of what kinds of changes can I survive? So how long can I live and still have it be, strictly speaking, me?
Well, thinking about scenarios and episodes in history that we can barely imagine today, going back to the 14th century, I've read a fair amount of history about what went on then. There was the Black Death, and it was the center of the medieval period where infant mortality was high, life expectancy was very, very low, and virtually everything about that time was involved with preparing for the afterlife, a sense of life itself having no value here, that everything was preparation for some judgment of piety that would take place towards the end of your life. It affected everything, every outlook. And it was all about this notion that life is short. Does an extension of life increase the value of life, do you think?
Right, throughout much of human history, because people, of course, don't, for the most part, welcome the prospect of death. They've held out the hope of surviving their deaths and there being some kind of an afterlife. And so when you change the vision of the world from a mere first act to the only act, that really does, I think, shift your focus on what you want to do with this life. If this world, this life, the 70, 80, 90 years, if I'm lucky, that I have are all I've got, I have to be sure to not waste that time, to spend my life in such a way that it's as valuable and makes the greatest possible contribution.
Although there's a limited incentive for getting off the couch at age 75 if you know you're going to live to 105.
Well, actually, an interesting question again about if you imagine life going on longer is where do the extra years fall in terms of our life story? Do we imagine the extra 30, 40, whatever it might be, the extra years coming after we've retired? That's a difficulty right away because most people currently don't save enough money for a retirement, let alone a retirement that's now two times as long, three times as long, four times as long. If instead you imagine the extra years coming during our working years, then which kinds of jobs are going to be sufficiently interesting to sustain our interest to work at the job for 80 years or 90 years or 100 years? Or do we instead imagine that what's going to happen is that people will at a certain point change careers, perhaps at the point where we would normally nowadays be retiring? But how's that going to work? I mean, who at the age of 60 or 70 or 80 is going to want to start over again at the lowest rung in their new chosen profession? So as I say, you can say we're going to use science to extend our lifespan by a relatively modest amount, adding another 20 or 30 years. But it's not at all obvious what kinds of changes we need to have in society in order to absorb even as modest a change as that.
Shelley Kagan is the Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure.
So do you have a story to tell about the implications of living longer? At what age were you your best and truest self? Or is your best and truest self still ahead of you? Give us your story at 877-8MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. On Monday, St. Patrick's Day, we'll hear from one Irish government minister about why the Irish government is not happy with the organizers of the St. Patrick's Day parade here in New York City. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.